It is no secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Yeah. The key thing is, don't be inhaling, don't be ingesting.
Stay inside, don't drink or eat anything.
These are important questions.
I understand that. Highest moment the last 8 years.
Highest moment the last 8 years. Well, I think the most important, the most compelling was 9/11 itself.
Welcome to the special live weekend edition of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett, and I've been doing this show since 2006. All over the alternative internet radio airwaves. I got started in 2006 with RBN, Republic Broadcasting, founded by the founder of the Michigan Militia, John Stadtmiller. At least I think that's a rumor about John anyway, and moved on to GCN, Alex Jones's network, and since then have been evolving into higher and higher states of radio consciousness by way of American Freedom Radio, and on to No Lies Radio, and finally here at Revolution Radio, where we do the live show every Friday night. Please do help out Revolution.radio. Help them be the best listener sponsor network. Go to Revolution.radio and kick in, subscribe, get into the archives. And don't forget to help me out at TruthJihad.com. I have a Patreon link there. Today we're going to one of the great many places where the mainstream won't go. In fact, a couple of them. Starting with the issue of what really happened with those airplanes on 9/11, and then moving to the question of how to help inform the public and get some positive change in the world around this kind of issue. First hour, we're going to have David Chandler of Scientists for 9/11 Truth. Second hour, Robin Horton, the whistleblowing ex-air traffic controller, who is a major source for David Ray Griffin's take on the 9/11 planes issue. And he's going to Portland tomorrow to do civil information activism at the courthouse, which is the focus of a near civil war, at least if you watch Fox News and Breitbart and stuff. But it's certainly the focus of some very bizarre warring factions in American political life. Robin may be the only sane person in front of that courthouse tomorrow morning. Anyway, let's get going here with the first hour guest, David Chandler of Scientists for 9/11 Truth. He, Wayne Costi, and others have been doing a detailed forensic analysis of what happened at the Pentagon on 9/11, and their conclusion, which is utterly controversial in the 9/11 truth world and utterly non-controversial outside of it, is that a large Boeing 757 almost certainly did fly from Dulles Airport on the flight path as described and as caught on the black box, and then indeed did crash into the Pentagon. However, whether it was piloted by Hani Hanjour, a doofus who could barely speak English and was unqualified to solo in a Cessna training aircraft, is an entirely different story. So let's get going with David Chandler. Hey, welcome, David. How are you?
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're coming through loud and clear. I guess phones still work. All right. Even in the Skype age.
Well, I have a new phone, so I just want to make sure that it was adequate here. Okay.
Okay, great. Yeah, you sound great. So you have a new video out, AA Flight 77 at the Pentagon. It's about, 20 minutes-ish and kind of covers your basic take on the issue of Flight 77. And it's very good, succinct. So when did that come out exactly?
I just got it out. I can't remember just exactly the day, but it's in the last couple weeks here. And it's really based on material that I was exploring it right about the time of the Denver conference about a year and a half ago. May 4th, 2019. And that's about the time I last interviewed with you, just before that conference. But the collaboration that arose out of that conference brought me in direct contact with Warren Stott, who was the one who decoded the FDR, the flight data recorder for Flight 77 and Flight 93, by the way, but we're not going to talk about that. But and so out of that, that merged together with some of the questions I was asking, and I started focusing at that point on what exactly does the FDR say about the damage path leading into the Pentagon, and how does that compare with what we can actually see on the ground? And so that's the basis. And so it's just pretty much mulling things over since then and talking it over with others in scientists. And we basically have emerged at the conclusion that this is actually very solid evidence that A, the flight data, the flight, the FDR is really authentic. And it being authentic, it ties the plane. It basically describes to a T the flight into the Pentagon, and therefore the entire flight of Flight 77 has to be seen as an authentic record there as well, because the whole thing is together. And so that basically has lots of implications. So the implications that came out of that is what motivated this video.
And of course, that's a very different take than some of the others on the subject. There's been a lot of skepticism about the air crashes or alleged air crashes on 9/11 on various grounds, including lack of the FAA coming in and putting together the crashes, picking up the pieces, identifying the parts as they supposedly always do, but right. They were barred by the FBI this time. And there are, of course, many, many other reasons why people have been skeptical about these flights.
Right.
So it's, you're doing now, you're fighting a bit of an uphill battle within the truth movement, which is kind of strange. I don't know. But I admire you guys, because my position was always I've been waiting to see somebody do a good detailed technical analysis of these questions and get a discussion going and a debate going. And it looks like you guys have done that. So now I'm waiting to hear what the other side has to say.
Well, here my side has to say first, so we can get that on the table.
It looks good.
You have something to respond to.
Right. It looks great.
Okay.
I'm not qualified to tell whether you have properly put together a black box flight recorder.
No. What I'm saying is, I want to respond to a couple of things. I don't know exactly how this all ties together, but I've been in this very heated Facebook discussion on this very topic, so I feel like I'm all primed for this interview. I've seen what the kinds of resistance people have to even in considering this idea. And one of the things that people constantly are coming back to is, well, what about all those videos, 80 or so videos or however many they ascribe to videos that have been withheld and all the rest? I just sort of came to an analogy in my head, which is at the World Trade Center, hey, they took all the steel, They did not make the job easy for us. They basically scrubbed the site. What they left behind was dust all over New York City. And so the guys on our team, so to speak, so we looked at the dust. We, in the generic sense, I was not involved in that direct analysis. But, Stephen Jones and others. And it was in that dust that they discovered the nanothermite and the iron spheres and lots of good reasons to understand the nature of what happened, despite the fact the government was not coming in and confirming anything. We basically did an end run on the lack of information by taking the information that was lying around and looking at what we had. And so in a sense, we're doing the same thing at the Pentagon. no, we don't have the government cooperating in a dozen different ways and so forth. But they did leak out those five frames of the plane crossing the lawn, and later with the FOIA, the videos, those came, two videos, that one of which contained those five frames, were released. The video from the Citgo gas station was released. And then
why do you think it took so long, David? Why weren't those videos out there within a couple of days of 9/11?
It took FOIAs to get them out. And I'm saying, we don't have control. We don't have control of what the government does. They're going to, for whatever reasons, whether they have something to hide or whether they just don't want to be cooperative or what, they withheld things. But we did get them out eventually. And if we just basically look at what we have, instead of just saying, well, we can't know anything until they release everything, that's not a productive approach. So I'm saying what we have looked at is there is a lot of photography that has emerged about the damage in the face of the Pentagon wall. There is no single photograph that shows the entire opening, but people have made composites from the various photos that do exist, and those date actually back pretty far. Jim Hoffman had a composite on his website before I was even involved in the truth movement. I came in about 2006, and he already by that time had information about the size of the actual size of the hole in the Pentagon wall, which is not this 18 foot or 20 foot or 16 foot, whatever they say. That opening is totally bogus. The actual opening is first floor, and it's about 100 feet wide, and there's further damage beyond the opening. So you really can't even account for the damage without having a plane whose wingspan is greater than the opening, because the wingtips didn't go in. The wingtips smashed into the outer wall and smashed in columns 18, 19, and a little bit of 20. And on the other side, it did damage beyond the wall there as well. So in other words, you have some basic information about the size of the plane right there. And they say, oh, this plane can't fit that 20-foot hole the size of a garage door, some people said. That's baloney. It's the hole is large enough for all the heavy parts of the plane, and the wingtips got dragged in. And the tail, there's damage that you can actually attribute to the tail, and all of this. And this was what Wayne Costi, I don't know if you ever interviewed him, but
I've interviewed Wayne many, many times. I'll probably bring him back before tonight.
All right. Okay. Well, he did an absolutely brilliant job of bringing all this evidence out, and he was initially on a mission to disprove large plane impact. And he basically proved himself wrong. And he said he lost sleep for many nights in a row, agonizing over the fact that his evidence disagreed with what he thought was the truth. And he eventually had to acknowledge that there really was a large plane. And then as he continued to bring the evidence out, it just piled on more and more confirming evidence. So this big long thread, by the way, that I was just on Facebook, it just went on and just all kinds of rancor. I found out how to end that rancor. I asked a question at the end. I just said, how many of you people who've raised objections on this thread have actually sat down and looked at the evidence at the Pentagon that Wayne and I put together? And I just said, I want to, have you done your homework? In other words, if you have an opinion on what happened at the Pentagon, you really need to at least be conversant in the evidence that we put out there. You might disagree with us in the end, but you need to see the evidence. You need to understand it and immerse yourself in that for a while, to even productively engage in this debate. And guess what? silence.
Well, that's unfortunate too. Because, I mean, again, we need people to actually get into the details here. And this stuff that you guys have shown is very interesting, and it's a good prima facie argument for the claims that you're making.
Yeah.
Now, let me.
It doesn't matter which side you want to argue. You need to understand the evidence that we have put on the table. You might decide that it's all baloney, but you need to see it first. And so that's the thing, is that there's been a reluctance for people to actually engage on a real level. They would rather sit back and spout their theories without any digging. We put in hundreds of hours on putting all this evidence together. And then my work on this last video is not just something I tossed together in a weekend. It's something I've been engaged in for a long time to try and come to grips with what is the data that's in the FDR and how does it relate to what we see on the ground. That turned out to be a very productive line of study, and that's what hopefully we'll get into in this conversation today, okay?
Sure, yeah. Let me pose a question that comes to mind, because your work, a lot of it, as you say, does rely on this looking twice at these Pentagon pictures and putting together a composite showing that there is actually a large, correct size hole in the first floor of the Pentagon, whereas there is a much smaller, too small hole on the second floor. And the first floor in most of the photos is obscured by smoke. So a lot of people in the truth movement always thought that that second floor hole was actually a first floor hole, which, of course, would be impossible for a plane entry. So that's a very interesting and worthwhile point that everybody should get familiar with. Look at the evidence for what you're saying about these holes. But this raises a question, David, that it strikes me as strange, and maybe you can tell me whether you find it strange as well, that the way this allegedly hijacked and flown by a human who, according to some, was unable to fly a Cessna training aircraft, the flight path of this thing, the fact that it did a corkscrew dive, did a corkscrew dive. It came down at almost 600 miles an hour, which is very, very fast for near sea level. And there have been various claims it's impossible, but we won't get into that. Anyway, a real stunt flight kind of maneuver. And then to have this plane coming in basically for a landing, it's the equivalent of a landing, but instead of a landing at 100 miles an hour, which is what these planes do in a real landing, it's coming in at 600 miles an hour for what amounts to be essentially a perfect landing, in that it hits only the first floor of this building. So it's as if, imagine that this area were a runway, okay? And let's say the pilot wanted to touch down at exactly a certain point on this really long runway. And if he comes in at 100 miles an hour, controlled by a computer, sure, he could probably hit pretty close to the spot on the runway he wants to hit. However, I've piloted planes. I don't have a license, but I used to go up with my mom and dad, both of whom are pilots. And coming in for a landing, one of the really hard things, if you're not experienced, is sometimes you miss the landing and you have to pull up, and you have to pull up because you've gone too far over the runway. You haven't managed to get your wheels down. So touching your wheels down in a training aircraft at very slow and hitting a certain point on a runway when you're coming for a landing is really hard. When you're learning how to fly, you'll miss, you won't even be able to hit the whole runway. You'll have to go up again and come back and try it again. So the idea that anybody, least of all a guy who couldn't even fly a Cessna training aircraft, could come in at 600 miles an hour instead of 100 miles an hour, and he happens to make what amounts to a perfect landing into the first floor of the building, putting that hole in exactly the first floor, but leaving nary a scratch on the lawn, this just strikes me as really, really bizarre.
Go ahead. So there's a lot of things about the way, what I see, the corkscrew turn was not such a big deal, it turns out. It was a pretty big radius, and a lot of people that have recognized that was not, at first people were saying, well, that was a hard maneuver. Well, maybe, but it's not where the real difficulty was.
For
the difficulty was
a
straight line. I'm just saying, just a second. I'm saying The hard part was that straight line where he was basically the last mile or so accelerating into the Pentagon. And the Pentagon is sort of in a down a slope. And so he basically had to follow the contour of the land. And it's, so he's in a dive, and but it's the plane, right? And one of the things that's been pointed out to me along the way, and I'm sure there's many, many features here. One of the things that would make this a difficult maneuver is he was accelerating. And as you accelerate, you're increasing the lift. And so you are having to compensate for the tendency to lift up, and the tendency would be to overshoot the Pentagon just from that. But in order to bring the plane down, you needed to be very conscious of the tendency of the plane to pull up. And so all of this stuff people talk about as far as ground effect, a lot of that is overstated. One of the things is ground effect tends to diminish at high speed, so that's not such a big deal. But this lift was a big deal. And so for them to be able to bring this plane down and basically target it, to hit the target right, that's where a lot of the difficulty was. And that's why, I mean, it's an unsettled question in my mind, but I think it's very plausible and very possibly very likely that it was, at least in that final approach, it was being had some kind of a guidance system or computer control or something, whether it was they're following a beam or whether it's something that's internal to the aircraft, whether the nominal hijackers were then being electronically hijacked. And there's, you know, so in other words, I think it was being controlled by a computer one way or another to bring it in that final stretch. That's where the really hard part was, given the it's in a dive, had to avoid the terrain and so forth. There's
no human would choose such a flight path, would they? I mean, wouldn't it be really easy to sort of aim it, come down into the top of the building, hit a really big target, just dive down into the top of the building rather than fly this path that so many things could have gone wrong? You know, it was like clipping poles and things like that. You know, why would you do that?
Yeah, one would think they would have chosen a different target especially if they just wanted to maximize their chances of just ramming the Pentagon. There'd be easier ways to do it. However, that's part of the whole scenario, is there's a lot of things that conspire to make it look like this was a planned approach that was executed via computer of some sort or another. So that's my bias on this. There are still questions to be resolved. And some of the people that are working with us on this, we have a couple of people that are commercial pilots. One guy is a commercial pilot. He's also an engineer. And there's another guy who's a Boeing engineer who's in on this thread. I mean, there's different people. And they differ on their opinions on this. And there's Dan Hanley over in Pakistan, who's very much advocating for what he calls the uninterruptible autopilot. So I don't know the hardware. I don't know the mechanisms. I'm not a pilot and so forth. So I'm sort of on the fringes of that discussion, but it's ongoing. And I'm just saying the fact that Honey Honjur may seem to be unlikely as somebody able to pull this off, I recognize what you're saying, and I basically agree with it, but the conversation isn't really concluded. So I'm just standing on the side of that one. So I'm not looking at that. I'm looking at the path that the plane actually took, as evidenced by clipping points on the ground and as evidenced by the flight data recorder. And that's where my focus has been. So I'm sort of setting aside the question of who or what was at the controls, okay? Because I think that's a distraction from what I'm looking at here. All right. You follow me?
Of course, but there's a problem with that, David, which is that if you limit your mission statement to what you just described, given the short attention span and limited cognitive capacities of the American people, it sounds like you're kind of defending the official story. People have been brainwashed to hate Muslims on account of blaming radical Muslims for this act, and that's led to the deaths of as many as 27 million murdered and another 5 million gone because their parents, or who would have been their parents, were murdered, according to Dr. Gideon Polia's analysis, and maybe fewer millions than that, according to other analyses. So there's a huge problem here of slandering these specific individuals who've been blamed for this crime but have never had anything remotely like a fair trial or anything comparable to it in which the evidence that should have been presented against them would have been presented to the world. Nothing like that has been presented to the world. And so, you know, what we have is a case of the murder of millions of people based on slander. And if you limit your mission statement to just saying, hey, it looks like Flight 77 did hit the Pentagon as advertised, that basically reinforces the slander. Okay, let's go out and kill some more millions of people.
Okay. I'm not making that my mission statement. I'm just describing the work that I have been focused on, as you sort of have to circumscribe what can I actually know, and what do we actually have to look at, and how do I come to these conclusions? So I'm narrowing the focus for my own particular project within a larger context. And of course, the questions you're raising are obviously part of the discussion. And I agree. I think the Muslims have been totally slandered in this entire operation. One of the things that people point to is that, one of the statements that gets made a lot is, well, the Pentagon is what made it an act of war, and therefore this is the most important point. Forget the World Trade Center, focus on the Pentagon. Now, the best evidence that the Pentagon flight was an inside job is the evidence we found at the World Trade Center. As soon as you have demolition going on at the World Trade Center, you have foreknowledge, you have participation by the U.S. government, and then the entire operation, all parts of it, are under that same umbrella. So it doesn't matter what the results are in terms of how the plane was flown or anything else. I think it is highly likely that the nominal hijackers were patsies. Whether they had some role in the flying of the plane during some part of the flight is another question, because some of the evidence in the FDR shows some parts of the flight were controlled by autopilot and other parts of the flight looked like they were very erratic in every which way. And one interpretation of that was this was a section where they took it off autopilot and you had an amateur flying the plane. So I don't know what role, if any, the Arab men that were on the plane, and I do believe there is evidence they were on the plane, but I don't necessarily, I don't see them as necessarily in the hijacker role the way they've been portrayed. And even if they were, they're not behind the orchestration of this massive event.
When you say they were on the plane, are you referring to specific individuals?
I'm saying there is evidence that unidentified people of Middle Eastern extraction, their DNA was found in the Pentagon in a location consistent with them being in the front of the plane. I'm just leaving it at that. So there appear to have been, based on the DNA evidence, there appears to have been, they don't have them identified individually because you need comparison DNA for that, but they have
the families of the alleged hijackers repeatedly demanded that, and the government, the U.S. government, ignored them.
Well, in the Massawi trial, they produced and there's an interactive database. I have it, and I can send it to you if you like. But they have an interactive database where they mark the location of each of the places where they found a DNA sample, enough body parts to get a DNA sample. A lot of these were just found with dogs and had and then scraped it off the floor, that kind of body parts, you know? So I don't know. There were a number of they have all of the passengers except for one presumably identified, and the one was a child who was on the plane. And then they have the DNA from accounted for all of the workers who were in the Pentagon who were killed. And they also have the DNA for several individual people. But from the DNA, you can tell that they were Arab or at least Middle Eastern or something, but they don't have comparison DNA. So they don't have them identified.
They're saying they have Barbara Olson's DNA?
I don't know. I mean, I...
Well, she was allegedly one of the passengers.
I haven't looked at...
Her husband, Ted, repeatedly told stories about her supposedly calling from that flight, and that's what gave rise to all of the cell phone stories. But as it turns out, Ted Olson was either lying or he had been phone spoofed, because according to the FBI, as released in the Massawi trial, there was no connected call from Barbara Olson's phone to Ted Olson.
Okay. I'm saying the database exists. The claim is that it identifies everybody except for one person, and it includes all the adults. And I haven't looked at the database specifically to answer that question, but I can provide you with that, and I can look now that you've asked the question. And I'm not even vouching necessarily for the 100% authenticity of that database, although it appears that it was a thoroughly done operation to identify all the body parts. They did the same thing at the World Trade Center, by the way. They went around with did a map for all the various fragments of human remains were. So there's a lot of stuff that, hey, you have to rely on somebody with official authority if you're going to look at forensics of body parts. You're not going to have some private outside individual doing that. It's going to be looking at a government database, and then you have to ask the questions, of course, do you want to believe it or not, and so forth. So
you mentioned the World Trade Center. So do you recall how many passengers' DNA supposedly were recovered from the Trade Center? Because over 1,000 people did not leave the slightest trace of DNA of people who were in the Trade Center. But you're saying that they found all of the passengers?
In the Pentagon, they located all the passengers. They counted for all of the people missing in terms of
what about the Twin Towers?
I don't know. I just know there is a database of the body parts that were found. This has not been the focus of my study. So I'm just reporting, you know, in my larger, on the periphery of the things I've looked at, I'm aware that in both cases, there are these databases of body parts. And I would like to know in more detail where all the body parts were at the World Trade Center, because some of those body parts were bone fragments on top of the Deutsche Bank building, which means, were those bone fragments from firefighters and or people who were in the towers, or were they, as claimed, people who were in the plane? It doesn't make sense that they were people in the plane, but that's the claim. How would you fragment body parts down to centimeter-sized bone fragments and eject them from the Twin Towers in such a way that they land on the roof of a tall building before the towers ever got to the ground? So we're talking about very specific evidence there. If we had, if we had information on who those bone fragments relate to, that would seal the case in a certain way. But the official reports are, those were passengers from the plane, but I don't buy that. But I can't argue otherwise, because how do you fight City Hall, so to speak, you know?
Right.
So that's the question.
Isn't it interesting that about a third of the people who were in the towers and died or said to have died were never identified from as much as a single bone fragment. That's rather right. Bizarre, isn't it?
Oh yeah. If they were crushed in a collapse of a building, they'd be in the rubble pile. But apparently they were blown all over New York City along with the dust. So that's my surmise. So that's, you know, that's gruesome to say it like that, but how do you account for the fact that they were not found? And either it was a rush job, let's get all this evidence out of the way, and so they might be in the Fresh Kills landfill, what an ironic name, or they just may have been vaporized in the process. So there's, there's lots of these. So all of this stuff, everything we've talked about here is on the periphery, and it's definitely essential material that the truth movement needs to address, and hopefully we can find answers to. But the way that I am saying I am approaching this is I have carved out a project, which is, can you tie the FDR to the damage? And if you can, that shows this is coming back, okay? This is coming back to where you're showing that if the FDR can be correlated with the damage in a convincing way, then the damage was caused by the plane that was carrying that FDR, okay? And then the fact is that FDR has on it the entire flight from Dulles to the Pentagon and 11 prior flights to that. So this has a lot of implications. And so if you can make that connection, it shows this was a 77. It shows that it was a continuous flight from Dulles to the Pentagon. And I know you're going to have Robin Horton on soon, and he will have a different opinion. But it basically rules out a plane swap. Sorry, Robin. That's my conclusion. So the whole idea of the plane swap was a interesting idea, and maybe there were gaps in the radar account that might have left an opening for that. But the FDR data, if you basically say the FDR that was for the Flight 77 is the FDR that was in the Pentagon, then you have a record of a continuous start to finish flight that seems to rule that out. So that's some of the implications, which is why the little detailed study I did of how what is shown in this video, for instance, that we were talking about here, is how the FDR data is tied to the specific points of contact between the plane and what was there on the ground on that final approach. You follow me? That has implications.
The video does that very well.
It's basically spelled out in the video. The one way that your listeners can get the full picture there is to watch the video. It's 18 minutes long, and it basically goes through and summarizes how I have concluded that the FDR is authentic, that the FDR. There's a lot of people who argue that for one reason or another, you can't trust the FDR. What about chain of custody? Could the FDR have been faked? My contention, and I can go through my lines of reasoning here. I have several lines of reasoning. The FDR data, I do not believe, could have been faked. And that's not just a simple statement. That's based on a number of things here. But part of it is the level of detail that I have been able to discover here puts the plane in the right place within inches of where five points of contact occur. So in other words, you have to have an alignment. So the direction of motion given by the FDR is precise to within a fraction of a degree. And so you basically have the points of contact spelling out the exact wingspan of the plane, which is like 124 feet and a few inches, and the exact spacing between the engines of the plane. And then the FDR provides the exact direction of motion to within a tiny fraction of a degree. And what you basically have there is a bond that's created between the data that we have from the FDR and the actual physical scene. So that is, that's where my focus has been. The rest of it is, what are the implications of that? And of course, the implications are interesting, but unless you can appreciate the rigor of those details, that's where the reliability of this connection comes in. That's why I'm convinced. Can I present one other point on this topic here?
Quick question. Are there people who are familiar with FDR data who have disagreed with this interpretation or not?
Yeah, there are. And I mean, they haven't disagreed with what I've said because I've just come out with this recently. But what they've disagreed, they found reasons to say the FDR was fake. However, so the primary thing is a number of people have said, well, the FDR would always have the ID of the plane in the header or in some way. I mean, I'm just paraphrasing it in rough terms. And that this did not have that. And therefore, this is a phony FDR. They're just brushing it off based on something like that. However, the identity of the plane, not so that we can understand it, but so that American Airlines could understand it. So an identifier for the plane and an identifier for the fleet number, I think that's what it is. It actually is there embedded in the data itself. So whether or not it's in the header, it is in the data. So it's not like this is unidentified data. And what Warren Stutt has shown, and if you listen to his talk at the Denver conference, he addressed this issue. And by the way, all of the resources for everything I've been saying are under the Pentagon tab on my website, which is 911speakout.org. Look across the top for the Pentagon tab, and there's a number of topics there. And one of them, it's a link to the, I think it's there. Anyway, there's a link to the Denver conference. It's actually being hosted on the scientist site. I have a link to it. So if you look at Warren Stutt's talk, if you have a question about the authenticity of the FDR, he addresses those concerns. My approach to it is it's not plausible that the FDR was faked. And so one of the reasons I have given you, but the other reasoning for that is this. If the FDR was fake, what was the intent? And presumably it would be to establish the presence of a plane that wasn't really there. If you're saying they didn't really hit the Pentagon with a plane, it was something else. And so they were faking the FDR in order to mislead you into thinking there was this plane, then the FDR should have persuasively shown you that there was a plane that hit the Pentagon. And what the FDR shows you, if you just open up the files and look at what was provided with the FDR, is you have the raw binary data, which most people would simply set aside. Then you have the output from a program that translates that into a human readable form, namely a spreadsheet, and that spreadsheet stops short. It's missing the last 4 seconds of the flight, which leaves the plane hanging too high and not yet at the Pentagon. So it does not persuasively point to the hole. Plus, there's an offset because the way that you get position information from a flight data recorder is you're actually measuring acceleration moment by moment, and you're integrating it twice, for those of you who know calculus. In other words, you're adding up the little step by step by step, and all those little terms that you're adding together, each one has a tiny bit of error, round off error and stuff, And so by the time you have located, you've basically tracked the position, there is a data drift. So the positional information in the FDR is off, but it's off in such a way that the direction of motion is precise, and it's only the fact that it's offset. And so if you simply take the path and bring it back into alignment with the physical evidence on the ground, the direction of motion, so you basically aim it at the hole in the Pentagon, the alignment you get is consistent with the direction inside the Pentagon, the damage outside the Pentagon, and it's consistent with the radar track. So the radar, the damage path inside and outside the Pentagon, and the majority of eyewitnesses, and I don't want to go there on this one, but there's over 100 eyewitnesses. Most of them put that plane right on that same path. So all of this is in alignment. And so the thing is, everything points at the Pentagon, except it doesn't go down far enough. In order to actually complete the picture, it took somebody with the degree of obsession on this problem as Warren Stutt. He and Frank Legg worked on this. He spent over a year working on this issue. He was able to reverse engineer the encoding of the binary data to recognize that the last block of data that was missing is actually there in the binary file, but it was unreadable because there was an error in the, it's like a parity error type of a situation and a Hamming code that's at the end of the at the end of the block that somehow was in error. And so that last frame was not readable. Okay, so he was by two different ways, he was able to compensate for the error, and then it does become readable. It brings the plane right down to the right level and puts it right in the hole. So it took that level of processing and reverse engineering the binary file to actually take this supposedly propaganda piece of, you know, here's the evidence the government's going to give you to show that it hit the Pentagon. And it takes all of that to get the conclusion that it hit the Pentagon. It does not look like the FDR was manufactured with that goal in mind.
And so quick question
it looks like
this,
a real FDR with real data.
Yeah. Could you clarify something for the listeners? That is, yeah. Okay, so there was this drift or error that had to be readjusted to give you the correct flight path. And as you say, it took Frank Legg and so on a lot of work to do that. And my question is, what caused that error? And would this be a normal thing? Let's say we get an FDR from any other plane that's flown any other trajectory.
Yeah.
Would you have to do the same thing to any old FDR that you got your hands on?
Yes. However, in the era of GPS, the GPS is going to override. This was all back in the era of inertial guidance. So you're relying on the accelerometers to do all of this. And they had to correct the offset repeatedly through the flight as they pass markers or whatever. So you'd have other sources of positional information, and they would make changes to bring everything into alignment. But the last part of the flight was not adjusted back. And so there is this. So this is a perfectly normal, this is nothing unusual about Flight 77. That data drift thing is a standard kind of a thing that you know you have to correct for. However,
amazing. Does that happen with other crashes? In other words, when people are trying to reconstruct plane crashes into the mountains in the Andes, do they sit down and have to do what Frank Legg did? And if so, why did Frank Legg have to do this? Why wouldn't somebody why wouldn't U.S. government officialdom or the FAA do this with 77 like they do with other crashes?
Well, I don't think the FAA I don't want to get into speculation, but I mean, you know, hey, let's establish the government is not on our team. They're not trying to cooperate with us. Okay?
Wait a second.
But it's not that
they're trying to say that this plane hit the Pentagon. Why wouldn't they show? Yeah. Why wouldn't they take the black box and show what it shows, just like they would if it flew into a mountain in the Andes?
I think they took the black box, they took the data from the black box, and when the FOIA requests came in, they said, okay, here's your data. I'm sure that somebody at the FAA did some processing on the data, and they got the information they were interested in out of this. But what we got hold of had this missing frame in it, and it was Warren Stutt, who was working with Frank, by the way, who was able to recover that last frame by determining the nature of the error. And that's a very interesting story, but it's in that video. So check that out.
And quick, but, we're almost getting close to the end. So let me ask the million-dollar question.
Okay.
Why in the world would the government behave in this way such that it requires such a heroic effort by you guys to reconstruct these things when, on 9/11 itself, we were repeatedly shown plane into building, building explodes into pyroclastic dust clouds, plane into building, building explodes over and over and over until we all were nauseated and having PTSD over it. Why in the world wouldn't those videos of the flight into the Pentagon also be shown repeatedly and quickly? Why did it take 6 years to get the government to cough up these security videos? And then the government never did what you guys did, showing that these security videos might actually show an actual 757. And likewise, why would the government not put out this flight data recorder with all of this information properly adjusted? Why wouldn't they have gotten that done within 3 days after 9/11? I mean, the government here has an interest in showing that Flight 77 really hit the Pentagon, and yet it's going to ridiculous lengths to withhold that very evidence, and you guys are having to bring it out. This is really bizarre.
Well, I think one explanation is they might like to watch us fight.
Frankly, you could be right.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a serious thing. Basically, we're talking about the Pentagon. They don't reveal anything. You know, the whole place is a culture of secrecy. So why doesn't the Pentagon release blah, blah, blah? The clear answer is
to support their
because
story
it's the Pentagon.
Right, but I mean, everybody does.
Well, I mean, you might.
Pete Carroll of the Seahawks, the coach of the Seahawks, right after he won the Super Bowl, you know, said, he started yelling at some military guy who came to do a patriotic thing with the Seahawks, saying, you don't really believe a 757 hit the Pentagon, do you? And this is very widespread. Why? You know, it's just bizarre that the U.S. government, which easily could have produced all this evidence that it took you guys so much work to do. They could have done that in 2 days in September 2001, and yet they never did. It's just very strange.
I think it's more likely that the government was out there supporting the disinformation. I mean, you have all of these myths that arose that are erroneous very early on. And at the beginning of the Wayne Coste video series, I hope people will actually look at them. It goes through how did we get here? And it goes through the whole litany of all the misinformation that we have been saddled with. And I think it was more to the government's advantage to have misinformation circulating around so that the truth movement's in chaos. I mean, that's the best motive I can see. So bringing clarity to it, I think, would be the last thing they'd want to do.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any actual evidence for the assertion that I've heard from people in your camp on this, that the fact that much of the truth movement has doubted the large impact into the Pentagon has discredited the truth movement in the eyes of the people who matter? That's an assumption that I've heard expressed, but what's the evidence for it?
Well, I just think that ultimately I think the truth is a large plane, in fact, AA-77, hit the Pentagon, and that all of this speculation that it wasn't AA-77 or it wasn't a large plane or it was a missile or it was a flyover, I think all of those can be, I think they have everything they need to discredit all of those if they ever need to come out and put the cards on the table. And so they're just watching us fight. But I think that it's important for us, for our purposes, I don't want to speculate ultimately on why the government might be doing what they're doing. But for our purposes, it matters that we get it right, primarily because we're a truth movement. And so if you focus on getting the true story nailed down so that we have a narrative that agrees with the evidence, that's our safest position. And so it's hard to argue with the truth when it comes down to it. So just because we have all these myths that have circulated from way back, and some of them, I believe there is intentional disinformation involved in some of this, and there's lots of unintentional misinformation involved in all of this. And then there's people who hitch their wagon to one of these theories and they have it all put together in a way that makes sense for them. And then you try to show them new evidence and they balk at it. And so I think there's a danger in that. And I think the safest way to get through the morass is to look rigorously at the real evidence and see where that leads. That's the only safe path. That's the scientific process. That's the only safe path through all of this, whatever the government's motives might or might not be. That's the only path that has integrity to it. And I think that's what we need to be focusing on. So if we call this a truth movement, I think we ought to call it the integrity movement. We need to get our act together and get the stuff right, figure out. I'm not claiming ultimate truth. I'm claiming that we have an overriding need to focus on getting at the truth. And you have to set aside your biases while you're doing that. And hey, not everybody has the skills to do what Warren Stutz does. I mean, maybe there's one or two people around that can do that. And not everybody has the skill to do the stuff I do, or the stuff that Wayne does, or whatever. But you know, we have a community effort, and I think there's a lot of people on in this movement that are doing good research, that have established a track record. I consider calibration of our reliability.
We're going to have to cut it off here because we hit the buffer music. But I agree, there's a very interesting conversation going on here, and I hope it continues, and we need to keep looking for the truth, even if it upsets our preconceptions. Well, thank you, David Chandler. Keep up the great work, and look forward to talking again.
And watch the video.
Okay, yeah, I watched the Flight 11 video twice, actually, and it's very interesting. Actually, I have more to say about it. Back in the next hour with Robin Horton. So, stick around.
If you think for one second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope. We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard, you've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look!
Just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I've seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, and stupidity.
I'll do you for that.
Oh, what?
Come here. What are you going to do, bleed on me? I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, yeah, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com.
Did you ever feel that things were not quite right? That everything was just ever so slightly askew?
Do you have, to paraphrase Morpheus, a splinter in your mind?
If you're interested in hearing the latest information about UFOs, the paranormal,
ancient cultures and structures,
monatomic elements,
longevity,
fantastic discoveries in science,
download it to your brain,
then tune in to us. Hi, I'm Dave.
And I'm Mackie.
And we are Shiny Side Out, Sundays 2 to 4 a.m. Eastern. See you then.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here. All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And now we're going to get back to your host.
Welcome back. This is the second hour of the live edition of Truth Jihad Radio. I'm Kevin Barrett. Going all those places that the corporate-controlled mainstream doesn't want you to go. Tonight, we're talking a little bit about the 9/11 airplanes. How did they set up this illusion that crazed suicide hijackers took over the planes and flew them into targets? That story has been thoroughly debunked at many different levels. However, the question of what really hit the Pentagon, what planes actually crashed at the alleged crash sites has been... avidly discussed and debated. David Chandler offered the conclusions of his research group in the first hour. And now to get a slightly different take on it, we're bringing on Robin Horden. He's a whistleblowing FAA ex-air controller who is now a pioneer of civil information activism. He is a major source for David Ray Griffin's work on the 9/11 planes, and he's going to Portland tomorrow to do some civil information activism at the courthouse, the site of the civil war between Antifa and the Proud Boys, or so we're told in the media. That should be interesting. Robin sitting there with his signs and handing out his stuff while the Proud Boys and Antifa are doing nasty things to each other. I want to see the video. Anyway, let's get into it. Hey, welcome, Robin. How are you? Hello, Robin. Do we have Robin on the line? Let me look at the... okay. Looks like we're unable to get him on Skype, so let me see if we can find an alternative path here to find Robin. Okay. Hello, Robin. Can't get you on Skype. What's your phone number? Hope he is around and available, because after that David Chandler interview, it'll be good to hear Robin's version of things. So let's see what we can do here. Sending him an email and looking here. Yeah, it looks like our Robin Horden Skypes aren't working there. Let's see if I can find one more possible Robin Horden Skype. And no, it's just the usual. Oh, well. See if we can try his other email address. And used to have a phone number for Robin somewhere, but unfortunately doesn't seem to be anywhere within reach right now. So hopefully he'll show up pretty. Oh, there it is. We got a phone number for him. I'm going to pass this on to Mr. Rowe, the trusty studio guy here at Revolution Radio. So here we go. Okay. Still not quite as good with this Microsoft Skype as I was back in the pre-Microsoft Skype era. Oh, boy. Okay, here, let me send it to Mr. Rose. And there's the phone number for Robin. And hopefully we'll be able to pull him up there real soon. So we're going to have a great False Flag Weekly News tomorrow. While we're waiting for Robin, I can give you a preview of that. Lucy Morgan Edwards, who worked for the EU in Afghanistan and then wrote a whistleblowing book on that, will be on False Flag Weekly News tomorrow. That's 11 to noon Eastern. And you can watch that Hello. By way of my YouTube channel. Hey, looks like we got Robin on the line. Hey, welcome, Robin. How's it going?
Very good, Kevin. How are you? I guess the Skype connection didn't work. I'm up and running, but I got no call.
Yep, we tried to reach you on Skype, and it didn't work. So maybe it's Bill Gates. I don't know. You got to blame everything.
You never know,
Bill.
Man.
Yeah, yeah.
Never know, Kevin. We live in interesting times, that's for sure.
We do. If Bill Gates has even done half of the stuff, sort of like George Soros, if these guys have done half of the things that have been attributed to them, they're supervillains that would make, Batman supervillains blush.
Yeah, this something different about the brains of megalomaniacs that is very, very troubling. You would think that they'd want to not have so much power and have things so much out of balance as when we consider nature. So anyways, troubles people.
Yeah, well, the world is largely run by high IQ psychopaths who have learned how to work with other high IQ psychopaths. Unfortunately, it's going to be tough changing that, but we're working on it. And you're certainly working on it with your civil informationing. Well, let's start with some informationing on the approach of David Chandler and Scientists for 9/11 Truth to the question of what those 9/11 planes actually did. And David just released a video summarizing his arguments that the flight data recorder plus the physical damage makes a very good case that indeed Flight 77 did hit the Pentagon as advertised, pretty much. And so he said, you have a slightly different take, and I know you've said that before, but let's get your version of events.
Well, yeah, I do. And I attended the Denver conference, I think it was last April, and saw all the presentations there and generally agreed with John Wyndham when he presented his wrap up down there, where he said he concluded that this same evidence established that it was most likely American 77. And I feel that there is a great deal of evidence that will allow me to take that position. The problem is that most likely is not proof that it was American 77. And there is enough information out there that still raises questions about the fact. I think that, and I want to just give a kudos to Wayne Cost, who was out there, did an awful lot of work at establishing what is a impact damage flight path that is hard evidence that is irrefutable that a large twin low underwing engined aircraft impacted the Pentagon, and the damage path starts out at a bridge quarter of a mile away or so where there is an unnatural cutout of the top of a tree, and then there's impact for the light poles, impact for the generator, impact with a low cement wall, impact with a tree leaving a stump just outside the Pentagon, and then impact with the Pentagon itself. So that is now done, okay? And the 9/11 Truth community, and I've seen the video and I'm pretty disturbed, and 9/11 Truth community has been infiltrated, you know, every way but Sunday from the beginning, and I'm not sure that it isn't still. Pretty sure that it is. So the issue that we have regarding the flight data recorder is, number one, there's no serial number on it, which is very troubling. It's modern, up-to-date Boeing 757, American Airlines, a major airline, which raises big suspicions. And the problem that I bring forward that I maintain only an effort of propaganda will try to refute is that everybody, starting with Jim Hoffman, Massimo Mazzucco in his great three-part series, splicing together a composite picture. Everybody knows that that aircraft impacted the Pentagon at a 6-degree bank left angle, but the flight data recorder shows the wings level at and just before impact. And this group's position is that a 50,000-ton temporary generator trailer that was easily pushed out of the way by the right engine, damaged, pushed out of the way by the aircraft's right engine, created enough force somehow for this banked aircraft that at the generator point and at the low cement wall point was in a 6-degree bank at that point, but that the impact with that generator somehow dropped the right wing and raised the left wing, okay, matching the flight data recorder. And that is about somewhere 50, 75, maybe 100 feet away from impact. I did a speed and time analysis, and that activity had to move 2/3 of the weight of the Boeing 757, which was the right wing and the left wing. It had to move each of those wings an average of about 6 feet, one down and one up, in 1/10 of a second. And that is just physically, the physics do not work out. You can't do that, okay? Physics don't work that way. Additionally, the left engine, which impacted the low cement wall, that engine basically was witnessed to have been blown apart and probably did not create any lifting action of the left wing. So and one of the experts in Denver, and he's mentioned here, is Warren Stutt, who seems to be very cogent in what he does and accurate in his stuff. But his stuff in a report has to be peer-reviewed. He discovered an extra 4 to 6 seconds of data that was somehow not read or hidden from pilots of the 9/11 Truth and other people who had looked at the flight data recorder. And that work, it just needs to be peer-reviewed. And it still establishes the aircraft, you know, at just less than a second away in level flight. So that's a big problem. So we have no serial number on it. And pilots of 9/11 Truth did their own analysis and did some work with the flight data recorder. And they show anomalies when it was taxiing after being pushed back from a gate, allegedly, at Dulles. And then Barbara Honegger, which I'll talk to you about pretty soon, had done an awful lot of work in analyzing a lot of the data regarding the flight data recorder that just didn't work in this flight. It just routinely and consistently didn't fit. And there's such a big problem in dealing with what the flight data recorder will show in latitude, longitude, positions in its flight as a function of time, matching basically 100% of the route of flight as put together by the RAIDS. It's an Air Force radar analysis group. And they, on a 200 or 300 mile scale, both flight paths look really identical in the 200-300 mile scale. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about the last half mile of flight, basically from the Pentagon on in, and now we're dealing with a matter of feet. And so that's a half mile scale. And at the half mile scale, the flight data information, the electronic flight data information, has had to be adjusted, quotes, adjusted for drift or whatever the term is. And that is fitting evidence into the theory. And that's a big problem. And I bring up Lynn Margolis' name all the time. You got to deal with all of the facts and all of the information. So there's several radar sources and the flight data recorder source, and the radar sources are somewhat compatible, given the difference in the electronic technical data that is used or is collected when the different radar antennas spin around. It's pretty hard to have all those in perfect synchrony. But
so Robert, let me just interrupt to clarify something here. David Chandler and his group say that the flight data recorder shows Flight 77 taking off in Dulles, flying a flight path out over Ohio, turning around, coming back to the Pentagon, and so on. So it basically gives the whole flight right up into the crash into the Pentagon. And you're saying that there's also radar data, FAA radar data showing the flight path. Does it also cover the entire flight path of this flight?
Basically, yes. But on the day of 9/11, part of the radar data was never shown to the FAA air traffic controllers out over eastern Ohio because of a computer programming problem that allows, that controls what radar data is fed into the FAA radar system. This is where my expertise comes in, along with a fellow named Tom Lush. So the radar data collection system from the antennas that we have all laid out across America did in fact see that primary target. And the problem is that right where that primary target was lost to positive radar contact because the transponder was shut off, again, that now it went invisible to the air traffic controllers, yet the radar data was being collected but not shown to them. And then Tom Lush, who was a 30-year FAA employee and radar specialist, has broken down the entire flight, and he shows right in the area where there were where the transponder was lost for American 77, that there were multiple primary targets in the area. In fact, his work shows that American 77 made a 360-degree turn out there, which the flight data recorder does not record. And so there are some anomalies that need to be dealt with. Now, I brought this information to and up, you know, up to the Pentagon study group, and I said, here's a real expert. And they said, no, well, we have our expert. It's John Farmer, who's an investigator, and he's not the John Farmer from the 9/11 Commission. He is another fellow who worked with a guy, an infiltrator named Miles Kara, who was working for the 9/11 Commission, and he was given all kinds of access to the NORAD information and whatever it might be. And John Farmer started to become a radar expert, or wanted to. He's some type of a detective or something, and he couldn't make the radar data fit, so he called me, and I had a 6-month conversation with him, and he said, I can't get this radar data to fit. I said, well, there's a difference between magnetic, you know, and true compass orientation all the way around. So I led him through this. So this guy, they claim to be a radar, he claims himself to be a radar expert, and he is not. And in fact, Farmer put together a report that this group depends upon, and the name of that report is Radar and National Transportation Safety Bureau Time Normalization for 9/11 Data Sources. And in this, what John Farmer does is he admits that to make his report work, he has to adjust the time, okay, tracks for all of the radar data sources that he got. In other words, he, John Farmer, did the same thing that Chandler has done, which is fit the evidence to fit the story. They adjust evidence to make it fit the story. Farmer he outwardly says, this is what I do. Once I took this and fit this into that and fit that into that and fit that into that, look, I got the story. So the fact of the matter is that because I'm so familiar with the issue of war games, I understand how the U.S. military makes war games. And they start out with an idea, then they load it into a computer, then the computer translates it into what ends up being, you know, fake enemy targets and whatever it might be coming in and, you know, attacking us and whatever. And that information is sent out to NORAD, and how do the interceptors scramble? And it's a whole big test of the war games. But the issue I want to bring out is that the flight data recorder latitude, longitude, geographical locations can be used to create radar tracks and radar paths across the ground, because it's all done in latitude and longitude across, okay, in time, and vice versa. You can take any one radar data and you can create some type of a flight that can basically be like an imaginary flight from a war game. Now, I painted that black and white and oversimplified it, Kevin, because it's so complicated. But the bottom line of the story is that Pentagon study group has accepted that, you know, to make everything fit, all they had to do was take the flight data recorder path and move it south some 50, I think it was like 400 or 300 feet or 600 feet, whatever. Chandler would know that because he did it. And then all of a sudden that flight path fits the impact flight path, damage flight path that I just described to you earlier. And there's a really big problem to that, and that is that when you move that flight data recorder or you move the aircraft south to fit where the damage path is, and you do the profile, the aircraft smashes right into the tall antenna that was right beside the now gone naval annex. So I have a huge problem with them messing around with data to make their story fit when what they should simply say is, look, here's the conflicting data, and here it is, and you make up your own mind. And then the only thing I've asked them to do, only thing, as I said, you have to inform the public that 100% of the data with which you are using to make your conclusion or soft conclusion that the flight data recorder did belong to American 77, the radar data comes out of the United States government. The flight data recorder information comes from the United States government after several years of not letting that information out. Now, the problem with that is...
And that's what's really strange, isn't it? As I told David, the government holding tightly onto all this stuff, which all, according to these guys, basically supports the claim that Flight 77 hit the Pentagon, is bizarre. Like, why would the government not be showing the video 10 times a day starting on September 12, 2001, if it really essentially shows a plane hitting the Pentagon? Why wouldn't they reconstruct their flight data recorder and so on and put all this stuff out there on the table? Why have they been holding it so close to the chest? And David, of course, says that, well, he thinks they're actually consciously trying to stoke fighting in the truth movement by confusing us.
Well, I think that that's true. They are stoking them, and David's playing right along with it by not announcing the fact that all the data that this group used to make their conclusion come from the primary suspect. I mean, come on,
right,
Kevin. The reason that we made so much positive movement with architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth is because the evidence did not come from the government, Kevin. It came from citizens who took photographs and collected dust, and then scientists did some measurements and whatever. And this is where I call David Chandler, I call him 2 Second Chandler, because he came into prominence because I don't know how he got into the position of being able to be the one to ask that simple question about the 2 seconds of free fall, when in reality, Sophia had this, I mean, Loose Change had this. Everybody knew that the building fell down close to free fall. So
he did the detailed calculations showing that it was in fact absolute free fall for 2.5 seconds. And that was a good contribution, and his work on the North Tower is good too.
I think it was a great contribution too. Okay. But there's other people that had been out in front of that, at some time.
Oh, yeah, so, Eric Hufschmidt was way ahead of his time on those demolitions.
And, and Jim Hoffman. And by the way, Jim Hoffman, who I think was validated by the Wayne Cost's work about a large plane impact, Jim Hoffman never said it was definitely American 77. He said the same thing that I'm saying, which is that it's most likely American 77, but there are too many questions that need to be answered and asked and answered, and those questions can be answered by the federal government saying, hey, why don't you just give us all the serial number parts that you collected from the aircraft or air vehicle that impacted the Pentagon? Well, they're not giving it.
And that raises a question, Robin, that basically David and others and all sorts of people actually always refer to these flights by the label, AA-77 and so on. But in fact, as you know, AA-77 does not refer to a physical aircraft. It's simply the flight that was assigned to a physical aircraft, which the physical aircraft is identified by its tail number. And it seems that even if a plane took off from Dulles and made the trajectory that the black box says it did and that the radars say it did and crashed into the Pentagon, that doesn't tell us which physical plane it was, even if it did take off as Flight 77. And that might be one reason why none of the debris with all of the serial numbers has been made, transparently been released. Colonel Nelson, George Nelson, was the one, I think, who first brought this to the attention of the public, that at the time he brought this up, which was 10 plus years ago, not a single a scrap from any of these four planes that allegedly crashed at four different locations on 9/11 had ever been identified by any of the parts. And, you know, all the parts on these aircraft have time and date stamps that would allow them to be identified. And so the physical aircraft that crashed are normally identified by the FAA, but in all of these crash locations, the FBI barred the FAA from coming in and doing the job it normally does. So this is the one of the questions, you know, why would they be hiding the actual parts of the crashed aircraft?
Well, I don't think they want any fingerprints found, Kevin. I mean, this is the point. I mean, the lack of timestamp serial numbers at the impact site at the Pentagon is really, really important, leading right to the flight data recorder, because you are correct. We don't know exactly for sure whether or not I feel that there's been more evidence supporting the other three aircraft. So, but I focus on American 77 because I know so much about, you know, intercepting and swapping aircraft. And I know so, cause I've done that, Kevin, I've intercepted, I have run hijacks. I've done all of that in my FAA career, so I got a good handle on it and understand how the radar.
You actually ran real live hijackings? You were involved in real hijackings?
Yes.
Wow.
Back in the '70s. Yes.
Like going to Cuba.
And here's a little tidbit, Kevin, that just freaked me out on the afternoon of 9/11. I worked as an air traffic controller, but I also worked in a thing. Some of my other assigned duties were to work in what we call an area office, which would be airspace and procedures. And the way the FAA develops its procedures works hand in hand with the military and vice versa, because you have to have both military aircraft and systems in airspace and FAA systems in airspace be completely compatible. So I worked in between the FAA and the military, often doing all of those things. And so one of the tasks that was given to me when I was on a small temporary duty in the management end of things is they said, well, we want you to be the liaison, and we want you to ask the air traffic controllers, okay, do they have any advice that they can give us as to what to do about managing and handling the hijacks, because they were just happening a lot in the mid to late 70s. And so I did that work, and here is what we air traffic controllers said to FAA management at that time: do the same thing that LAL did and harden the cockpit doors.
Which presumably they did, because suddenly hijacking stopped in the 80s and
90s.
Isn't that right?
No, they did not. The only time they hardened cockpit doors was after 9/11 2001.
So why did this huge rash of hijackings in the 70s suddenly stop?
I believe it was because we got better at collecting intelligence on the ground, human intelligence on the ground, and a lot of that stuff was taken care of before they got on the air. Plus, airport security was really, really heightened. No, Kevin,
about 9/11 is that there hadn't been any successful hijackings for almost a couple of decades, as I recall, and then suddenly on 9/11, these four groups of total doofuses, you know, the basically low level drug smugglers working for organized crime in the CIA, apparently, who'd been brought, you know, the 15 Saudis were brought over here on CIA snitch visas, meaning they were CIA informants in Saudi Arabia. They were rewarded by being given a trip to the United States, and they were brought into the United States. They partied on military bases, secure U.S. military facilities. The Pentagon even offered a non-denial of that, basically confirming it. And they were running around smuggling cocaine, all the cocaine you could snort, drinking heavily, partying on Abramoff's casino boats, flying repeatedly to Las Vegas, drinking like fish. Muhammad Atta spoke fluent Hebrew and dated a pink-haired stripper. The real Atta, of course, didn't speak any Hebrew. So anyway, all sorts of monkey shines were going on with these alleged hijackers, and they were essentially not serious individuals at all. and not totally incapable of flying airplanes. The 9/11 Commission said Heinie Hanscher was the best pilot, and he couldn't even handle a Cessna training aircraft. So these people, they couldn't have stuck up a convenience store successfully, and yet we're told that these guys succeeded in hijacking four aircraft when there have been no hijackings in 20 years. Nobody can hijack an aircraft in the United States anymore, but somehow these guys, you know, couldn't stick up a liquor store to save their lives, have succeeded in hijacking aircraft, taking controls, and flying into targets in rather difficult ways.
Being a pilot, I understand about navigation, flying aircraft. I'm only a pilot of light aircraft, okay? But I understand it, passed my flight engineer basic on a Boeing 727. So I understand the theory of flight. I understand high-speed aviation. I controlled aircraft for 11 years. I get a lot, okay? So the preferred word, okay, that I use when I talk about those four aircraft versus, quotes, the hijackers, is I say to you, no, those four aircraft were commandeered one way or another. And if there were or there weren't Muslims on board, and again, the DNA report at the Pentagon shows no Middle Eastern body parts, okay?
And of course, that's not what David said. David just said on the show that it does show, quote-unquote, Middle Eastern body parts.
Yeah, well, that's been revised information because the original information that came out did not have it that way. Anyways, that's, again, more reason to continue to look for it, okay? So what I'm saying to you, and one of the things that really infuriated me about this movement, is that I made it abundantly clear to David Ray Griffin. I begged him on some of his books. I said, look at David, the hijacking protocols were actually followed. That wasn't the intercept protocol that was broken down on 9/11. The June notice, June 1, 2001, amendment to the Joint Chiefs of Staff operational procedures essentially, threw confusion into the relationship between the military aviation elements and the FAA aviation elements, in that it was hinted, and the procedure that was changed were that all scrambles had to be approved by the Pentagon, when only before that, only hijacking scrambles had to be approved for the Pentagon for national defense reasons. Okay. But air traffic controllers, Kevin, me, when I served and we intercepted a small twin Piper PA-23 who had lost all radio contact and was in cloud, lost all radio power, I should say, in clouds. When we scrambled, okay, the military aviation aspect, we did not, Kevin, we didn't ask the Pentagon. We got on the hotlines and said, we need an aircraft of yours up in the air. Now we have a lost aircraft. And that aircraft, it was a C-119, I think, ended up being in the aircraft within 12 minutes, scrambled from a local base, and we vectored the aircraft over, the military guy, over to in cloud, over right beside this PA-23. They did the rocking the wings, and they both ended up landing at Keene Airport. The guy came, the pilot of the lost aircraft came over to my center, and he shook all of our hands, and he said, thank you. And I said, well, you're welcome. That's what we do. So, Kevin, the protocol that was changed on 9/11, or in June, 3 months before 9/11, was the in-flight emergency intercept protocol. Now, I basically badgered David Ray Griffin to include this in his books, and finally it broke through. I think it was Bonnie Faulkner, okay, in an interview with her. Finally, I broke through, and the Jersey girls got wind of this, and they said, oh, no, there's two protocols that broke down on 9/11 for intercept. But the real only protocol that broke down was the in-flight emergency protocol, which means that an air traffic controller can declare an in-flight emergency and reach out to the local scramble base and get the aircraft in the air in a nanosecond to get on the tail of this aircraft having an in-flight emergency. American 11 lost the transponder, lost the radio contact, and veered off course without air traffic control approval. The air traffic controllers that they felt that there was an in-flight emergency going on and was requesting help really early, right away. But what happened is because Cheney had thrown in that June change 3 months earlier, some supervisor, the way that they changed it, well, we can't scramble aircraft now because Cheney said that we have to go through the Pentagon. And that was the delay. I begged David Ray Griffin to do that. Finally, in his new Pearl Harbor revisited or whatever it might be, he put one sentence and maybe a footnote to correct it into that book. And that's a book that nobody read. So I'm really pleased that I have had a chance to explain to you and everybody else, it was not the hijacking thing. Those aircraft were commandeered. I'm not really sure that it was done by the Muslims. They may have been on board. They may have not been on board, whatever. So,
well, you know, interestingly,
complicated, Kevin.
Yeah, indeed. Well, I thought David Ray Griffin did mention that protocol having been changed in June in earlier books. But maybe I learned about it somewhere else and just thought it was in David's book.
No, hijack protocol. He did not mention in-flight emergency protocol till I think three books later.
I see. Okay. Interesting. Well, you know, speaking of the question of actual hijackers, that's one of my issues with the way David does stuff is that, you know, he's really unfamiliar with the literature showing really, I think, beyond any reasonable doubt that these guys that they blamed as hijackers were innocent patsies. And that literature, you know, includes such books as Elias Davison's couple of books on the subject, as well as a couple others. Graham McQueen shows that the alleged hijackers were sheep dipped in anthrax, presumably by neocon intelligence agents, which again reveals them as total patsies. And then Daniel Hopsicker's work on the way these guys were obviously not radical Muslims. Not one of them had a political bone in his body, had the slightest interest in politics or radical Islam. In fact, they were radical drinkers, partiers, you know, pink-haired stripper daters, and CIA mafia drug smugglers who pretended to learn to fly at drug import airstrips and who hung out in the gym. The National Security Agency gym, it's technically private. It's right across the street from the NSA gates in Bethesda, Maryland, and it's used almost entirely by NSA personnel. And that was the gym where a large group of hijackers spent much of their time. These alleged hijackers also hung out in many secure U.S. military facilities, partying like crazy with U.S. military people, and the U.S. military offered a non-denial, confirming that that was the case, and on and on and on and on. And David is completely unfamiliar with this. He hasn't read Elias Davidson's work.
Kevin, that's why I'm so terribly upset, and why I'm saying, and you can see it at 4 minutes in. They take a picture, they show a picture, show it time and time and time again, where the image of the aircraft up against the Pentagon has the aircraft wings level, when we all know that it's all in a 6-degree bank, and the damage to the facade of the Pentagon establishes and physically proves it was in a 6-degree bank. So I have to say that this is propaganda. Kevin, this is propaganda. A mission in Denver to get this quote scientific thing allegedly, okay, settled, but it was thin on the reality of issues surrounding 9/11, some of which you just talked about, and that is that this is an intricate operation, and that the CIA and the military know how to sheep dip. Lee Harvey Oswald, we've heard this story before. They know how to do all of this stuff, and they did it. They set up Muslims as patsies, whether they were on board and it may not be, whether they weren't on board, one way or another, the aircraft were commandeered. You've got a guy named Lewin on American 11.
almost certainly flown by mechanical means, not by human hands on board.
Absolutely. Kevin, absolutely. I mean, I was aware of remote control and highly sophisticated navigation and autopilot systems decades ago. Of course they have it. We're droning the crap out of the planet right now. We had all the ability to do that. And there's been a tremendous navigation study put out there. I've forgotten the fellow's name right now, Aidan Monahan. And he found all the information, the aircraft were mechanically, electronically commandeered somehow. And there is the possibility. I mean, Jesse Ventura has an informant that said that his sources tell him that, quote, the hijackers, didn't say Muslim, okay, were in the cockpits before they took off. Well, Kevin, as an air traffic controller, I flew between a half a dozen and a dozen times in the cockpit of airliners on what we call familiarity trips, fan trips, on the jump seat. You can get in those cockpits, but nobody wants to deal with Ventura because he's Ventura. No, so that's what I'm trying to tell you. The problem that I have is that Chandler has narrowed down this 18-minute video, okay, and has completely disposed of all of the background information which need to be known to understand the full picture, because when you do understand the sheep dipping, the full picture, how well the CIA runs black operations, I call American 77 the Operation Northwood Flight, Kevin, okay? That was back in the 60s. Swap the aircraft. Now we have an FAA radar expert who says, you want to see where the aircraft could have been swapped right here? Tom Lush, TOMLUSCH.com. Go look at the video, and you will find out that there were multiple primary targets in the area that, quotes, American 77, or that flight, okay, went through. Well, if you have a swap scenario, Kevin, one aircraft has to come in, one aircraft has to go out. There are multiple targets in that short area. I'll talk later about this because I want to talk to the veterans today and get some real good radar data, get some radar information. But the point I'm trying to say is,
Robin, we're getting towards the last sort of 10 minutes ish of the show. And maybe we could quickly hear about what you're planning to do in Portland, because essentially you've become a pioneer in civil information activism as you're researching 9/11 from your expert standpoint as an ex-FAA guy. You're also going out there at Seahawks games and putting up signs, going into parks and places where people congregate, not that they congregate much anymore now that there's COVID, and handing out literature and talking to people. And you're going to Portland to do that at the courthouse tomorrow?
Yeah, not at the courthouse. It's going to be in the streets of Portland, and then we're going to do what we do, informing the people, the drivers by the pedestrians, with our messaging, and then we're going to go to a park. I have completely rebuilt and reversed the 60s, 70s tactics of big marches, which are useless. They march from nowhere to nowhere, in front of no one, only with people who don't need to be informed, and they're underreported by the oligarch media. They're useless. Protests. We all now know that protests, if they last long enough, or actually they don't have to last long at all, for the infiltrators to come in and throw a couple of Molotov cocktails and other dangerous things in where they break down, okay, and they end up exhibiting the exact opposite of what you went there to protest or what you went there to march in the first place for.
But wait a minute, Robin. Wait. We have a counterexample here, though, where the BLM protests include a fair bit of seemingly provocateur-type stuff, a lot of looting and arson and things like that, and yet the media is apologizing for it. NPR is bringing on an expert who wrote a book on why looting is just fine and dandy. It's a good protest technique. So the mainstream media is covering up for the looters. How does that,
Kevin,
reflect your theory?
The oligarch media, in which I include NPR, are all bought and paid for by corporations. All right? They're the oligarchs. They're protecting them. They never tell the right story. And this whole Black Lives Matter thing being undermined right now and being shown, being able to be shown to be or protected to keep whatever it might be, it's a big mess, okay? And the bottom line of the story, it ends up being a political tool for the Republicans, for Trump and his guys to, you know, let's reclaim the cities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What I'm saying to you is the only reason that I go to protest is to protest protests, okay? Because they're stupid. They don't work. The only thing that works changing this government is direct local political action where you organize locally and you let your political power trickle upward, and that is what I am doing. I am going down. I told all
the
news media.
So when you protest a protest, how do you do that? How do you protest a protest?
I go there with my signs, and my sign says don't. It says pretest, don't protest. That's how I do that. I'm telling
pretest?
The protesters you're doing the wrong thing again, and you've been doing it for 50 years wrong. So the way to do it is to inform the people.
How do you inform them? Do you hand them leaflets? Do you talk to them? How does that work?
Yeah, and I stand on street corners, and you make very simple messages, okay, and you let them read it, and you give them some, you know, show some websites. You do other types of data, like healthcare, not warfare. I do that. You know, for Native America, I say, you know, support indigenous issues, you know. I have about 30 different messages depending on what it is going on, whether it's a Women's March or whether it's Earth Day or whether it's, you know, the Worldwide Peace Day that I was just out on the street for 2 weeks ago. It's messaging to the people who are driving by in cars or assembling at big places. The concept of what I do, civil informationing, is you bring your message to where the people are versus – okay, asking the people to come to where your message is, which is what it was like when we were back in the 60s and the 70s. It's a waste of time to march. It's a waste of time to protest. You stand outside a courthouse and you're yelling and screaming at the courthouse? No, you should take that same energy and use it before you have to waste your time protesting. Before, get engaged in politics earlier so you don't have to wait, everything is wrong, and then you have to get so pissed off you're going to go out there and protest.
Well, wait
so
a minute.
I'm down
wait,
there just letting
Wait
let,
a minute, Robin. Things are massively wrong and have been massively wrong for quite some time. I don't think, you know, in my lifetime, I was 4 years old when JFK was shot. You know, how am I going to get in front of the stuff that's wrong?
The only way, I've concluded that in my years, the only way we can do it is try to uphold, okay, and try to put forward quotes in our democracy that informed consent should rule. Informed consent. So that's why I call it civil informationing. I'm just asking people to become more informed themselves outside of the oligarch media and then have conversations with your neighbors, your local area, and then form local political groups, you know, and start electing better dog catchers and mayors and state representatives and senators and presidents.
The COVID thing tells us we can't gather with people anymore. Do you think that that's partly deliberate? Could this pandemic partly have been engineered to make sure that we interact mainly online and we're afraid of each other and never meet together face to face again?
Here's my answer. Here's what I call this, quotes, pandemic. Corporate COVID. When this is all said and done, corporations are going to have – the big fish corporations are going to have consumed and swallowed up all the little people, all the little people's businesses and this, that, and the other thing. You're damn right, Kevin. And I'm telling you right now, part of the whole deal is because we have these ornery people like 9/11 truthers and other people who are truthers out there digging and getting into, okay, spreading the truth. We have the internet for a while anyways. We have radio shows like yourself. We have some stuff that we can do to start to inform the people. Now, I go outside the local high schools here, and I have a very good reputation with local high schoolers. Guess what? They're pretty smart, okay? They got this stuff pretty good. The only way that the oligarchs continue their oligarchy, Kevin, is for them to control the information. They cannot have informed consent, you know, out there. They can't have informed citizens. They can't. George Carlin spoke beautifully to this in one of his bits. Okay, that's what they worry about. That's why I call it the oligarch media. There's not one major media, including Democracy Now, that in my opinion, actually goes out of its way to honestly and openly and in a balanced way try to inform people. That's why the kids don't read the papers. That's why the kids don't watch, you know, these stupid news shows with the million, five, 10, $25 million a year talking heads who get paid and told what to say. They're all the same. It's got to break outside of all of that, Kevin, because if it's not broken outside all of that, what happens is they can tell the stories they choose to tell, and this is why they wanted the Black Lives Matter, okay, to come to the forefront right now, because there was so much other stuff that was going on. And now this COVID thing breaks out. Oh, you remember all that gathering you used to do? You can't do that anymore. And music, Kevin, you're a musician. You can't play music anymore. Yeah.
And you can't spread conspiracy theories over the internet anymore, because that means you're a threat to public health.
I understand, but they can't stop me from standing on a damn street corner with my messaging and saying, hey, look into this, hey, look into that, or here's a different idea, okay? I got arrested, but they dropped all charges, okay? And now all the charges have been dropped, Kevin, okay? And now we're suing everybody from the janitor up in the county and in the port.
All right. You turn the tables on.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Absolutely, I turned it. Of course I did.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm trying to turn the tables on this 9/11 truth thing.
It's very, yeah, very, very cool and inspiring.
Yeah, and I'm trying to turn the tables and get this group that Chandler apparently represents, okay? They're convinced, okay, that there was no simultaneous or early explosion. One of Honegger's best bits of work was to postulate and collect evidence that there may have been simultaneous or earlier explosions at the Pentagon. All logical, all the way through. She was great until she just went off the track with the exploding white plane, and she undermined herself. I'm so frustrated at her. But the bottom line of the story is that the system wants to indoctrinate Cheap Dip with stories that they conjure up. And when Chandler puts out a video and it shows an aircraft entering or hitting the Pentagon with its wings level, this is the exact same propaganda, but in a different realm.
We're going to have a technical discussion on that, and I'm not even sure I'm qualified to be part of a technical discussion about the wing level, and there are many other issues like this. But thank you for adding your interpretations on that. Simple informationing, Robin Horton. God bless. Thanks.
All right, Kevin. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Kevin Durr at Scout.com. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.